My name is Rich, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and your understanding. Phil will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Phil, I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me this serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Mariah will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Mariah. I'm an alcoholic. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics and to practice his principles in all our affairs.
Brian will read the traditions.
Hi, my name's Brian, and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first speaker tonight is Brooke.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Brooke. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Debbie for the opportunity to speak tonight. It's an honor and a challenge to come and speak in front of many people. On the other hand, look at how many people are in this room. I am not alone. So thank you all for being here. My sobriety date is October 4th, 2006. My home group is the Atlantic Group. My sponsor is Susan S. And I'm a little nervous, so I'm asking God to help speak through me and help the newcomer. I grew up in an alcoholic family, in a dysfunctional family. My mother stopped drinking, got into AA when I was 10 years old. By the time I was 17 years old, in high school, I graduated with an A-plus in drinking. I had a lot of reason in my eyes to feel full of fear, to have a lot of self-pity, to feel different from everybody else, to be angry. And when I put the drink in my system, I felt a lot better. I drank because it helped me feel like the person I always wanted to feel like. I had some help learning how to get into drugs and alcohol. My four-year-old, my brother, who's four years older than me, taught me a number of things. There's a passage in the big book that says at some point in our drinking careers, we passed a point of not being able to stop. We reached a point of not being able to stop the consumption. I'm sorry, I can't remember exactly what the word is. We reached a level of consumption of alcohol, a limit. And when I got sober and started doing my step work, I could look back and see that when I was 17 years old and I was drinking many cans of beer and many shots of hard liquor, like Southern Comfort, Jack Daniels, Old Granddad, there's another, Cutty Sark. I was drinking that straight out of the bottle. I had lost my consumption way back then, and I didn't know it. Although all along, my mother got into AA when I was 10 years old, so she had introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and she also introduced me to adult children of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she did her best to try to help me to become aware of the disease. She did her best to help me become aware that this is a disease. My disease had other plans for me, and I didn't come into the rooms for 27 years later. And after high school, my body, I believe, was all set for the alcohol. I could consume a lot. I could handle my hangovers for many, many years. I continued to drink through college and my first professional job. I did a lot of partying in the dance floors and clubs. I spent a lot of time on the weekends partying. I spent more time as my disease progressed in my 30s. The hangovers started getting worse. I started going to work stinking of alcohol from the night before. I started going to work afraid that the people didn't like me and that they were out to get me. So I was always very conscious and very self-conscious about others around me and whether I was pleasing them or not, or what I needed to do to please them or not, all along carrying a whole load of anger, trying to hide it all the time. By the time, a year or two before I came into the rooms, my alcoholism brought me to the loss of a job, more drinking at home alone, conscious drinking before I ate, because I knew that the alcohol would hit me harder when I was on an empty stomach. Starting earlier in the day, hangovers were into 3 days, and I was also grateful for 3-day hangovers because I knew that I wouldn't drink during that time, and that's almost the only way I didn't drink, was when I felt so sick from hangovers. My higher power, I understand now, has been with me all along, carrying me through to this day that I'm standing here right now talking to you. But to help me get in these rooms, my appendix ruptured, and I had no job or insurance at the time, and I went to the county hospital. And I was in the emergency room for 10 hours before they operated on me. And a man came to me who had access to my emergency records, at which time I told him how much I was drinking and drugging. This man came to me. He's from the state of Illinois, working with the Department of Drug and Alcohol Rehabilitation. And he said, "Would you like to talk to me about your drinking?" And I said, "Yes, I really would, but I'm going to get an operation soon, et cetera, et cetera. Can you come back?" His name was Michael, and I call him my angel. He came back 3 days. He found me in the room where I was recovering. I was still very, very ill and coming off of morphine. I couldn't talk to him at that time. I said, "Can you come back?" He said, "Yes, I will." 2 days later, he came back, and I was able to sit up in the bed, and I was able to talk to this man about my alcoholism. And at that point, I started to break my denial. I went home and had a very long recovery from the ruptured appendix. I couldn't eat or walk for many days. And as soon as I was able to start sipping chicken stock with rice in it, I was also sipping wine. And the wine was burning in my throat and burning in my stomach. And I kept doing it until that pain went away. And by the time I was strong enough to walk, I got myself to the refrigerator, and I watched my hand go in and reach for the bottle of wine in the refrigerator, and I knew at that point I could not control it. I was watching my hand take that bottle, and I didn't have any control over it. And so I called the phone number that this man, Michael, had given me. I thought I was going to be able to get some free therapy again. And I made an appointment with the person on the other end of the phone. And at 8:30 in the morning, I went to this appointment. And I was at the Haymarket Treatment Center in Chicago for alcohol and drug abuse. I had no idea what that was. I was sitting with a man doing an intake interview. I have 1 minute left. My intake interview took 8 hours, and I felt like the man had a sledgehammer helping to smash my denial. And the last thing that the head of the treatment center said to me that I would like to pass on to the newcomer, she didn't have a sledgehammer, she had a feather. And she said to me, "Brooke, if you decide to come into the treatment center, it will be the best decision you've ever made for yourself. And that reached my heart, and I was able to go home and stay away from everything, and 4 days later walk into the treatment center. And I haven't had a desire to drink since. I've done everything everyone's told me. I love AA. It's changing my life. I'm able to live in reality, which is beautiful, as well as scary. And today, instead of living in fear, which is F everything and run, I am in recovery, which is face everything and recover. And I hope you all stay and face your fears also. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Josh.
Thank you. Thanks, Marty.
Hi, I'm Josh. I'm an alcoholic. Wow, this is amazing. I got sober on October 7th, 2007. My sponsor is Piotr. He has a sponsor. His name is Duncan. I'm a member of AG, a proud member of AG. This is amazing. Wow. All right, here we go. I was raised in Michigan. I'm an only child. My parents are still together. They are not alcoholics. So what's my problem? Actually, once I got sober, you know, over the past, I'm sober now a year and a half. I've been doing a lot of thinking about one thing I've learned in these rooms. There's a lot of amazing teachers in here, a lot of people with amazing sobriety in here. If you're new, your first meeting, you have 13 days, a month, and you're here, you hit the jackpot. This is an amazing place. Amazing things I have learned through people with great sobriety. And I've learned that I have a disease of perception, that I have a thinking problem. I no longer have a desire to drink, but now I'm dealing with sobriety, so that's what I'm dealing with. And so I've thought about my life and if I had any kind of alcoholic thinking before I ever picked up a drink. And one of my earliest memories was fourth grade. And I was always very good at school, straight A's. And the first time I remember really having a problem was in fourth grade, and it was a math problem, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but I think it might have been division for the first time or something, but it would just baffled me. For the first time, I was baffled, and I remember just writing, I think, off the page, like it was just going, it was probably something very simple. And the teacher, I just sensed, was behind me, and she just looked at me, and she said, "You're making that much harder than it needs to be." And that's sort of the story of my life. I can take anything that's simple and just really screw the pooch. And I also just remembered last week, I used to read film magazines, and in the back there'd be these cool ads, and this is way a long, long time ago when I was thinking about this, late 70s, early 80s, silly t-shirts, and this was before I ever picked up a drink. There was a t-shirt that said, and this is back when Chevy Chase was popular, he used to be funny, everyone, he really did. It said, I don't have a drinking problem. I drink, I fall down, no problem. And I wanted that shirt really bad. It was hilarious to me. I just remembered that. That's craziness. I picked up when I was about 16, and very similar story to you know, just garden variety here. You know, wanted to be cool, wasn't cool, had straight A's, wanted to be cool. So got rid of the glasses, got contact lenses, started drinking. Homecoming dance. I don't know if this is the first time I drank, but this is the first thing I remember. A bottle of peppermint schnapps shared between three guys, the whole bottle. I don't remember much, but I do remember leaving the football game and Chuck, this guy Chuck E., I won't say his last name because maybe he's, you know, who knows. He actually, I was driving my parents' Volvo, and he took my keys, my parents' keys. He was like, "You're too drunk to drive. I'm driving." And I got home somehow. I don't know how. The car was in the driveway. It's usually in the garage. So that was it. My parents knew something was up. There was all sorts of crap in the back of the car. I woke up the next day with a hangover, which I thought was so cool. I was like, oh, this is what that is. This is, wow, I don't remember anything. I didn't know where I was the night before, and I didn't have my glasses. This is before I got the contacts. So I had to call Chuck, like, where were we last night? You got to take my, my glasses are gone. I thought this was so awesome. So then that's the first thing I remember. So then it speeds up. Things get bad. I go to college. I know I didn't drink every day. And you don't have to screw up your life. But I drank so much that I wouldn't show up to classes. I actually got a talking to my junior year from the dean of the school. We were allowed a certain number. I went to a conservatory training program. You could only miss 5 classes. I missed like 12. And the dean took me outside of class one day and said, you know, we should have kicked you out, but you showed a lot of promise, blah, blah, blah. And if you promise not to miss any classes next year, my senior year, you know, we'll let you back in. And I said, sure. And, you know, once you're in your senior year, you're cool. But so I was just, you know, problems. And then I want to get into sobriety here. So I do remember one very bad night about 10 years ago. I had a friend who owned a bar, and another night where I don't remember getting home. In the middle of winter, a lot of snow. I woke up in fully dressed, face down in my bed, in a pool of vomit. Cut up. No idea what happened. None. How I got home, what happened to me. You know, I could have died. I could have died a lot of times for a number of reasons. The school I went to had a reunion, and I met a friend, and that friend asked me out to coffee one day after the reunion. This is about 4 years ago. I met her hungover, half hour late, and this woman was in the program and was doing an amends to me, which I thought was weird. We had some tears and some laughs and told her everything was fine. But that seed was planted. The seed of AA was planted in me that day. And we stayed in touch. And I reached out to her about 2.5 years ago. I went to a meeting. She took me to a meeting 1 year before I came into AG. It was the first meeting I went to. And I was blown away by the amount of young people and good-looking people. And the speaker was amazing. But I saw God everywhere. And that freaked me out. And I thought, this wasn't for me. She found God. She was born again. That's cool. You know, it works for her. But this was not for me. So I spent the next year bottoming out really bad, really hard, really fast. Things got extremely dark. And I called her again. And she brought me here to Tuesday night and introduced me to Peyote. And that was my day 2. And my life has changed immeasurably. And the God thing is no longer a problem. And one of the ways that helped me with that was looking at all the people of different denominations, because I had this wrong idea that this was a Jesus program. And we have this beautiful, 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 beautiful place that if you just look around and look up at the ceiling, it's just, we are blessed to be here on a Tuesday night. This is an amazing place. But there are people of all faiths, all denominations, and we are all accepted. And I get to choose a God of my understanding. I get to create a higher power for myself. And that's what was the hook that I needed. And I've just, you know, it's been progressive, not like a white light experience. It's a little at a time, and sometimes I lose it. And I find when I lose it, it's those times when I'm not doing the work, when I'm not applying myself as I should be. And when I do the work, it comes. It's astounding. I remember when I had 32 days, I was walking down the street. And I was thinking in my head, just, I have 32 days. And the moment I said 32, the 32 bus went by. And I was like, wow. You know, and little things like that happen. They happen, and it's freaky, and it's awesome. And, you know, I had a day like that yesterday, and someone came into my life yesterday. I was feeling a little strange, and I work in a restaurant, and someone who I was with when I bottomed out, who I haven't seen in a year and a half, came into my restaurant, and it really, I went into a little bit of a freak out mode. And I have actually gotten a sober member a job there, and he was working there, and he talked me down, and I was able to speak with her and talk to my sponsor about it and face her and ask her to make an amends tomorrow, which is the next right action to do. And everything in my body wanted to scream and run, and I didn't. And I have support, and I have teachers, and this place is amazing. And I thank you all so much for my sobriety. Thank you.
Now, our main speaker tonight is Peggy.
Thank you. Thank you, Marty. Hello, hello. My name is Peggy Byrne. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to give you some stats. I belong to the Atlanta Group. My sponsor's name is Peggy M. She's from Nebraska. Thank you. Speak into the... I would kill people when I sit there and they don't speak into the microphone. So where was I? So let's see. I live very, very, very happily in 10, 11, and 12. Now, something that Brooke said about having surgery... A couple of years ago, I had surgery, and they interviewed, the anesthesiologist interviews you, and it seemed like they interviewed me like three times. So finally, I said, what else can I say? They said, well, we want to be sure that we have all the facts. I mean, so I said, you have it down. I'm an alcoholic. And she looked at me. She said, how much will you need? That's... honest engine, and that reminded me. I hadn't thought of that like in 5 years. I broke up a fight this morning. Unbelievable. Two women in their 50s. The guy they were fighting over had to be in his 70s. And no, but they were really like fisticuffs, punching each other. He's my man. And they said, he's mine, I'll cut you. I mean, they were like, they were carrying on. I'm going, where were the parents? Had to do that. I have, for all our day counters, oh, God bless you. I'm so happy you're here. Every single one of you will contribute something to my life. No mistake about that. I have 13,170 days. I did the calculation before I got up here. 13,000. Okay, now 13,170 days ago, did I have any idea? Do you think I had no? Remember, it was 1973. We had very little information. If there were public service announcements, two a year maybe, and at the beginning of it, I mean, it certainly didn't apply to me, so I wasn't going to listen to it. I had no idea what was going to happen in my life. I did not. Anyway, I started to get the idea that I had a problem, and the problem could be alcohol. Now, of course, I knew why I was drinking. I mean, my 15-year marriage failed. You know, he left me for a Playboy bunny. I mean, that's enough to drive anyone to drink. And I always say this. I have to remember to say this. She wasn't any cuter than me, believe me. She wasn't. But she did have a bunny tail. She did have a bunny tail. You know, years later, I said to him, why? He said, Peggy, you know what it was like going into the Playboy Club every night? It was like going into a bakery. You know, it was lemon meringue. It was chocolate mousse pie. And I said, well, what was I, like prune Danish? You know, anyway, I don't know. Little do we know. You know, marriages end. They don't fail. They don't necessarily fail. It ended. It was supposed to happen. Everything in my life had a purpose. Every bit of pain is beauty. You know why? It got me here, but I didn't know that. I remember the day we signed the divorce papers. I waited because he was, a little after. I signed and left, and then I waited outside, and I looked at her, and I said, Red, that paper doesn't mean anything. You are my husband till I die, and I am your wife till you die. And let me tell you, when I got home that day, thank God the vodka was there on the rocks, and I said, what do I do now? What do I do? How do I go on? How can I live my life? I remember calling my sister and saying, I don't think I can make it. I don't think I can. But of course, I had the medication and it helped me. Thank God I had alcohol. It saved me for a long time. It absolutely did save me. But anyway, when I got the idea, slowly, little by slowly, that I was not feeling good and would stand there at the mirror and look. And that's pretty vain. I worked for an ad agency. By the way, Mad Men, my life. I worked for a Madison Avenue agency from 1959 to 1969. I have sent 3 emails to Matthew Weiner, the director. Talk to me. It's my life. And what's interesting is, the character's named Peggy, nice little Catholic girl. Somebody knew me, Somebody read. Now, ad agencies in those days, they don't do this so much, but everybody drank at lunchtime. We went out to lunch. Everybody had, a few shooters. I remember when I, very young, starting out, and they would say, have a drink. I would have a Hilti Dilti. That was a drink that was, I think like, the shot of creme de menthe and like 16 different fruits in it. And I thought it was so exciting. I was so grown up. And I couldn't wait to get started on martinis. And people would say, martinis are brain destroyers. Oh, were they? Were they ever? But after the separation, now I had to drink away really the pain of life. Life was too, it was just so painful. And I started, the series of doctors, and at that time, Marilyn Monroe had OD'd. They thought on pills and booze. And when they were, I would say, isn't there a pill that I could take to make me feel better? And no doctor, I remember at that time, asked me how much I was drinking. Which is a commentary on the medical profession, because I don't really think that they're asking today. So I suggest anyone in this room tonight that's thinking maybe they want to stop drinking, or maybe they should mention to their doctor, for the heck of it, to see what they say. But I didn't want to. I was afraid to take the pills. They we didn't have Xanax. I think it was Librium and what was the other one? The other goodie, Valium. Anyway, now after my separation, I met a great, incredible guy, Lou Fagelli, an amazing guy. And I always say this: he was to pay for every sin that Red committed for the next 5 years. And I remember when I did get here, I would do anything that this woman Rosemary at the I'm jumping ahead because I want to get that. This is so funny. I would do anything that she told anyone to do. I thought there was a book that you all read, that you all looked at and you all recited from. So she would say, I don't want you to see him for 30 days. So that night I saw Lou and I says, I can't see you for 30 days. And he said, why? I said, it's a rule. We don't question. And actually that was exactly what I did. I did not question anything. But to back up just a moment, I want to hurry up and get through, because I don't want to get lost in this drunkalogue, because too many things have happened in 36 years that I want to tell you about. But I finally worked with a cameraman. And they said, whenever there was a party, you know, we can't invite him because he's an Alcoholics Anonymous. And they would all laugh. And meanwhile, he looked great, and at parties, he always had a better time, it seemed to me, than anybody. So now I wanted some information about maybe I should find out about this. And we didn't have the internet, so I started looking for him, and I couldn't find him. But I did have something in a book called Under D for Desperation in my planner, and it had intergroup's number. And after I had gone to yet another doctor and had a series of tests and found out, believe it or not, she told me my enzyme count was like 570, and what does that mean? She says it's not good. And there is a program on the west side, and I said, wait, doctor, because I told her I was a little concerned about my drinking. I said, no. If you're telling me it has something to do with drinking, I will never drink again. I actually thought that I would never. And man, I left there, did I need a drink. So now it got to be a series of Sundays was my last. I remember looking at that bottle would be my last. Meanwhile, I didn't tell anybody about the enzyme count, which is in plain English, cirrhosis. I wouldn't dare tell because then you would tell me not to drink. I knew I was going to stop. And it got to be Sunday and then it was the last, and I would look at that bottle as it went down. Sort of the way I do now with Tasty Delight, you know? It's like my last day on Tasty is Sunday, you know? Which is all about addiction, really. Anyway, it got to be a Monday, and I went to work, and they said, it was 1 o'clock. Peggy, we're going to, we used to go to the Mayfair, 54, walk down to 54th and birth. And we're going to lunch, and it got to be this Monday, and I said, no, I didn't go. And for four nights, I did not drink. Did not go to a meeting, didn't think, and I thought the first night, this is amazing. Why did I think I had a problem? I mean, it's Tuesday. I'm in bed at 8 o'clock, but I don't have a problem. Anyway, got to be Friday night, came home from work, walked in the center of that living room, and the weekend looked like 5 years. 5 years ahead. And I said, I can't do it. No. So I immediately went in to get my bag, to go out and get, and said, wait a minute. Lou had given me some literature. He had told me, I work with people. He worked for a major newspaper. I work with people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always say this, it had 150 letters. Alcohol, it seemed like it never ended. And he said, they're always reading stuff. And he brought me an envelope. I cherish that. It's a number 10 Kraft envelope. It has his name on it. And in it, well, anyway, so now it gets to, I'm going out. I don't go. I go in and I get that literature and I take it and I look and I see, wow. Now, in 1973, there were 974 AA meetings in Greater New York. There's something like 5,800 now in Greater New York. But I looked at that paper, very thin, cheap paper. Now, it was in advertising, so I knew that, you know, there was good paper and there was terrible paper. And, of course, after I did my critique of the paper, flipped through a little, and it was a long book, and I thought, wait a minute, these are AA meetings. I'm not the only one. Amazing. Sat down, said a prayer, and I must tell you, you know, being raised in the home I was raised in, really devout, devout Catholic, I had not prayed in a long time. And that night, I said a prayer, which was major, which I believe, you know. Well, I believe that walk into the bedroom to get that literature was that moment of grace that we all have. It was actually the hand of God. And I called into group, and I said, I have a friend. And they were, oh, babe. It's exactly what I said 3 years ago, babe. We've got to get you to a meeting before the bars close. You know, what I really wanted to say is I'm not having any fun in a bar. I'm dying so well behaved and well coiffed. I look pretty good. I'm dying, but I look pretty good. I'm not having any fun in a bar. But he said I'm going to have, after he qualified to me, I know now, he gave me 15 minutes. I said, why is he telling me all these intimate things? He said, I'm going to have someone call you. She called me. She made a date with me. She told me, you're so lucky there's a beginner's meeting tomorrow night, which led me to think there were three a year, and I was lucky enough to go on. And we went. So I met her the next day. We went to Madison 73, up the elevator to the fifth floor, Madison 73. 7 o'clock meeting. Packed. We were there maybe at 1:45. Now, she interviewed me for the whole way. And I thought she was taking notes, you know, and I lied, and I had no idea what the truth was anyway. She said, you know, how long you've been drinking? I said, a month or two, or, you know. How much do you drink? Three or four, an hour. She was a young actress. Now, on the elevator on the way up, she said, I know I'm home when I smell coffee. And I thought, oh, the cynic, that little tiny bit of cynicism was left. Just a little tiny, tiny, tiny bit. Thought, oh, really, Saturday night, we're having coffee. And I walked in that door. Now, the person, you know, it took 14 seconds, I figure, to get through that door that we went through. It was crowded. It was up the stairs, if any of you know that floor at Madison 73. It was crowded with people, and everybody looked happy. Everybody, I thought, was snapping their fingers to the music. The metaphor for Alcoholics Anonymous, the music, the party. She introduced me to people, and they all wanted to give me, they wanted to show me the big book. And I thought the big book was the size of that panel, you know, that they were all going to show me. And they were giving me literature, and it was incredible. And I listened to a speaker who was a young man, gay, from the West Side, who drank scotch. And everything he said, I mean, we were polar opposites. Everything he said, I identified. Everything, I wanted to jump up and down. Why don't I have a notepad with me to take notes? I could not believe what I heard that night. But you know what I really heard? You're going to be okay, Peggy. You're dying, you know, physically, mentally, spiritually. But you're going to be okay. There was hope there. I would not have been able to articulate it that way. But that's really what I heard that night. There is hope. So the person that walked in that room, just to give you a little bit about my personality, I knew everything. I knew the answers to everything. You had financial problems, I'll fix them for you. I'll tell you how to live on a budget. You had relationship problems, oh, honey, can I help you? I'll tell you. I knew. I was the source of all information. And the person that walked in that room that night shed that mantle. And I knew nothing. I knew absolutely nothing. And I remember I went home from the meeting very, very excited. Very, so excited that I wanted a drink. Oh, God. Now, I thought, and I really, really wanted a drink. And what I needed to was to come down. I needed a drink to come down. But I thought somebody said, if you drink, you can't come back. So I didn't take that drink because I wanted to come back. Now, Lou picked me up. We went to dinner. He worked for a paper, you know, got off at like 10 o'clock. And we met friends, and we went to our usual restaurant. And the waitress came over. And before she said anything, I said, no. No, no. Never again. Never, never again. Okay. So the next day, the next day, it was Sunday, we went to Sunday, and he insisted on coming with me. Not only did he come with me, he met a bunch of people that he worked with who were in the program and took 10 of us out to dinner after the meeting. And I remember me asking them, is there a pill that I can take to sleep? Because I don't think I can sleep if I'm not drinking. And they laughed hysterically. Why? They, no, we don't do that. We don't do that. I said, and I want to lose 5 pounds. He says, oh, no, you have to have candy and ice cream. And I said, I do? Oh, I was in love. Yes, had a Sunday. Okay, so the next day, it was Monday, and I went, and she, by the way, she told me on Monday, the gal I called her, who I thought would be my sponsor, and she said, no, you'll find a sponsor. What not to do? What not to do to a newcomer? And she told me, oh, so Monday I went to, it was called a contact group, it met at Mustard Seed, and then she told me on Tuesday night, go to the meeting, it's the Midtown group. So now I want you to know that this edifice is kindergarten for me, grammar school, high school. In this building downstairs was the Midtown group. And I remember walking down those stairs and thinking, oh, this is what they think of us. They put us in a super sub basement. But it was okay. When I got down there, I was probably, if I wasn't the first, I was like the second or third person there. And I said to Rex, who was making coffee at the time, when are they serving drinks? You know, it was all about bravado, you know, like, how do I make you laugh? And he said, no, we don't serve drinks here, but we serve something better than that. Now, they asked at that meeting, quick, I want to go through this, about, they asked for volunteers. Rex was going in the hospital, and they needed volunteers to do coffee, and I raised my hand. And there were about 30 hands raised, and meet us after the meeting. And after the meeting, 15 of us, you know, of the 30 met. And they told us what to do. They said, you have to come at 5. You probably won't leave until 10 because we have cups and they have to be washed and all. And two of us showed up on the Tuesday night. The two lucky people, me and a guy by the name of Pat. And when I was doing it for about a week, Rosemary came over and said to me, we had a special meeting last night. We're going to make you director of refreshments. And I said, wait a minute, me? Are you sure? Oh, yes, we're sure. Yes, we're sure. And I did that. So, next thing I tell you is now in 36 years, I've had some incredible titles on business cards. Very beautiful. And the one that I'm most proud of, director of refreshments. I could not believe my luck. I couldn't believe it. And, of course, the treasurer would tell me every week, Peggy, we're giving you $20. Whatever you spend over that, babe, that's out of your pocket. Because I put doilies out. I insisted. Now, some of you from our meetings know about my quest for doilies, right, Robledo? I thought that was, it was very, very important. Okay, so now the work has to begin. The Midtown group had a step meeting on Tuesday, and we were given a number to go around the table. So, you know, there's a line, I think it's in the 12 and 12, I think it's the fifth step, where it says that the steps are contrary to our natural desires. Totally contrary. But I wanted to be well. When we would go out after a meeting and they wanted to talk about fashion and movies, I'd say, no. I know all that. Tell me, how did you do the third step? I mean, I was looking. I wanted you to give me the mechanics. Because I was kind of mocus. Reading was very, very difficult. And it was great that we went around the table. And now I must tell you that my relationship at that point with my higher power, whom I choose to call God. I remember, you know, as a kid, I would call on him. I had a little connection. You know, when my father would be coughing, I would say, oh, God, please, Daddy, stop coughing, you know. Or when I wanted to pass that, you know, math test, please help me open up the brain cells, you know, so I can pass. So I knew, you know, I had a connection to him. I would ask him. But I'll tell you where I really met him. I met him in this program. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a relationship that is so amazing. So amazing. Here's what I've learned. But, I mean, I had to do the work to get closer to it. I must tell you, you can't, it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen until we really get it out of the way, until we do that fourth step, and we get to do, we trust another human being with that fifth step. The only way, for those of you, for anyone that's having a struggle, you know, with the God of your understanding, the only way that he is not there for you, there's only one thing that you have to do not to have him in your life, and that is to reject him. If you do not reject God, he is like in a heartbeat, in a flesh, in a blink of the eye, he is there and wants to be. Every prayer is answered. Prayer changes everything. It does not change some things. It changes every single thing. Now, when I was sober 10 years, I was on my way to the gym, and I saw people going into the little church in my neighborhood. And I had not, even though I thought I was definitely a Catholic, I was, and I was a good person, and I was sober, but I didn't think I had to do that. You know, I didn't think. And I said, gee, let me just check it out. And I walked in, and I remember saying to the Monsignor, who I had met, actually, 10 years before, because we started a meeting in that church. So, you know, I figured he might remember me. I remembered him. I said, Monsignor, do you think I could sit in the back? Because I had my workout gear on. He looked at me like, you know, as though there's no dress code in church, you know. He went, yeah, it's okay. So I sat. And the next week, going to the gym, I stopped in before the gym. Eventually, it happened that I would go to church dressed and take my workout gear. So Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the faith of my childhood. It gave it to me back. And so another funny story about that is, had that not happened, had I not, and of course, as we do, we're all of service. We're about service wherever we go. So when they asked in Mass, when, you know, they needed people to take a course to be Eucharistic ministers, actually extraordinary ministers, and then for lectors. And of course I did, because wherever we go, we're compelled to give service. Wherever we go, there is someone to serve, wherever. And we're so lucky that we really get a chance to do that. So now I consider myself running the parish, you know. But because of that, the Monsignor, when my job ended in December 05, recommended me to the church that I work for today. Now I thought, work for a church? I'm a film person. I'm advertising film. What am I going to do in a church? Me. I have to tell you, I have the most amazing job, the most amazing, amazing job. Not only do they, oh, by the way, I didn't tell you, I went to school, I got a degree. Everybody thought I was in graduate school at the agency, and, you know, I was getting my undergrad. You know, I was always great with numbers, always, but now, of course, you know, now I have the theory. I don't know why I'm telling you that, except that, that's one of the amazing things that happened in sobriety. So many things like that happened to me. But anyway, I was hired by this church now 3 years ago to do their accounting. And as I am wont to do, I looked at the whole big picture when I was there and said, oh, there's a lot of stuff that has to be changed here. Like scheduling all these brides. I have to get involved in that. So now I schedule all the brides, all the weddings, and I schedule all the baptisms. And when a bride calls up and says, I need to have a date, I would like to get married, and I'd say, tell me what you want. I will make all your dreams come true. Consequently, I'm the only wedding scheduler that gets gifts. I get gifts. I get thank you notes. I get gifts. That's just, you know, part of the fun of doing it. But I get to evangelize, too. I get people that call, you know, and I get a lot of these calls they send to me, and I get emails of people struggling with their faith. You know, I've been out of it. I don't know what I want to do. And there are a few of them in this, you know, this meeting that have gone to RCIA. A little encouragement for me. It's an amazing, you know, just an amazing job. The, you know, the kinds of fun that I have, Sober Club Med, you know, sober cruises, I mean, amazing things that I'm able, that I go on, that I'm, it's absolutely incredible. The kind of friendships I have, my friend Marlena is here tonight, you know, Marlena, people think when I was in an emergency room a couple of years ago, Marlena came in and the nurse came over. She said, "Your twin sister is here." And but Marlena's that kind of friend. She's amazing. But now Marlena, I'm flattered when they say that because I'm older than Marlena. And Marlena's flattered because she thinks I'm prettier than she is. So, you know, we're both served. You know, we're both served. But I get to have that kind of incredible friendship that I would not have had. I always had lots of friends, but I didn't know their soul like Marlena. You know, I know Marlena's soul and she knows mine. We cry together, we laugh together, we've been through everything together. Oh, by the way, I want you to know about Love Inch. And I was telling this to someone tonight. You will fall in love with the same intensity every time until you're, you know, even 105. But the breakups get easier and easier and easier. And, you know, the other amazing thing is that I get to sponsor women that enrich me. You know, and I have all kind. I mean, you know, I have intense ones, and I have sober brats, and I have, you know, spiritual soul sisters. I'm the luckiest woman in the world. Thank you.